this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is Tariq Hussain, an accomplished journalist, broadcaster, and travel writer. Tariq has written travel guides for Lonely Planet and won awards for his BBC World Service radio documentary, America's Mosques, a story of integration. His new book, Minarets in the Mountains, A Journey into Muslim Europe, is the first book by a Muslim writer to explore Europe's indigenous Muslim communities, culture, and heritage. Tariq travelled, along with his family, throughout the Western Balkans to discover a lesser-told version of Islam in Europe. Tariq, thanks so much for joining us on this programme. I really think that your background and your experience of growing up in Britain is so important and so informative to what then comes in the book. So tell us about that, because you talk about growing up feeling like there were huge swathes of society that hated me just for being me and would happily kill me to prove that.
Yes, indeed. That might sound like an overstatement now. And actually, sometimes I struggle to get those sentiments across to my children, who, in spite of what is still going on, in spite of all the horrific vitriolic stuff you might see online and sometimes even being said in public, still, it's impossible for my children sometimes to appreciate exactly what I experienced as a child and what people of my generation experienced as a child. In fact, writing it felt slightly traumatic, because I went back to a time when I knew that there were individuals out there who wanted to kill us. And that's not an overstatement by any stretch of the imagination, because we knew about the racist attacks that led to the deaths of people like Altab Ali in the East End of London. Later on, during my lifetime, Quddus Ali, who died again because of his race. And we knew people were hospitalized, people were often permanently damaged, be it physically or mentally, because of these attacks. And of course, I witnessed attacks on people myself and narrowly escaped them, by the skin of my teeth.
I mean, you were born in Bangladesh, you grew up in Tower Hamlets, and this book was written in 2016, which was an incredibly racist time in this country.
Indeed. It was a time when all of the vitriolic, nasty, xenophobic, racist and Islamophobic sentiments that had clearly been simmering just beneath the surface came pouring out, riding on the wave of, for me, what felt like the extremely xenophobic and Islamophobic Brexit campaign, where certain individuals claimed that to remain in Europe meant that we would be swamped by swarms of Muslims groups, and in particular Eastern European migrants. These were the ones that were often plastered across certain newspapers and certain tabloids. So what happened was this kind of era where we had gone through kind of accepting that Britain was multicultural, these people were here to stay, they were a part of the fabric, etc. Suddenly, those who had never really accepted that felt it was okay to voice that. And that's why that particular summer felt awful for us. And we're a family of mixed race, so my wife's family is from England through and through. And so it was a bizarre time for her as well, because she's a Muslim and she suddenly felt, for the first time probably, that she also wasn't wanted here.
Which is why this book I found is so hopeful, because you're going to tell us about the journey, but you essentially go to the Balkans and find communities of Muslims and Christians and other religions really living very vibrant cultural lives close together, that actually this is a future that's possible.
Indeed, we come across communities that are living side by side. And the reason why they're able to do it in spite of the horrors of the 1990s, which I'm sure you're aware of, Georgina, when horrific ethno-religious wars took place. And of course, there was a Muslim genocide in Bosnia. But the reason that they're able to revisit, certainly in parts, I know there are parts where it's very, very difficult now, is because they had a history, and that's the history that I'm trying to bring to the surface. They had a history of coexistence, and it was largely because that part of the world was ruled by Muslims. Now, I'm not trying to lionize Muslim rule or trying to suggest that the Ottomans were any better than other colonial movements, but certainly during their rule, Jews, Muslims and Christians, at least, if not other faiths, were living in relative harmony.
So the Ottoman Empire, let's go back to that, because essentially what you did was let the renowned medieval Ottoman traveller Evliya Çelebi take you round Europe. How did that journey begin for you?
So the journey began and ended in Sarajevo. And if you mean in terms of the thinking, the reason why I wanted to go on the journey with my family, it had obviously been planned long before the summer of Brexit. A journey like this does take that time. Is because we wanted to visit a place where there was a living Muslim legacy. Your listeners will be well aware that Islam is not new to the continent, but they might believe that it is actually only a historical presence in places like Spain, where it arrived in the Mediterranean within the first generation of Muslims in the 7th century in Cyprus, and then had a huge presence in Spain. But that presence is historical, and that presence is no longer alive, as in it's not part of that legacy. And that can often be dismissed as, well, there is no kind of indigenous Muslim presence in Europe anymore. And I wanted to prove that there is. So that's why I went to countries like Bosnia and Herzegovina in particular, Kosovo and Albania. These were three countries very important to the route because they are Muslim majority. And then I also visited Serbia, Montenegro and North Macedonia because I knew large segments of those countries still had indigenous Muslims there as well. And there was huge amounts of historical evidence in those places. And Evliya Çelebi had lived and travelled through those areas and vast expanses across the globe, actually, at the height of the Ottoman Empire's rule. And therefore, he was travelling when Muslim Europe was at its most expanse. And these areas were the most Muslim they'd ever been. And that's why Celebi's perspective is so important, you see, because I had no other Muslim perspectives on this region in the English language. Çelebi's work is obviously translated. And that became really, really significant because there was no other way for me to establish what had been wiped away, eradicated, denied, suppressed, or even deliberately hidden to deny the fact that certain places were Muslim or that certain people had been Muslim for a very long time.
I mean, you're a seasoned travel writer and you've written about places from a purely factual point of view. This book obviously goes much deeper than that. And I wonder how it was shaped by journeying with your family.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, you know, that was a significant part of it. And in fact, I remember when I first wrote the draft, I realised that this was a very deeply personal journey about our family collectively looking and seeking for our heritage and obviously in the process aspects of our identity that we had never fully had access to. Now, my children weren't consciously aware of this because you don't take your children on a holiday and give them an academic thesis. You just take them on holiday. And so it's now looking back, obviously reading the book as well, they're realising the significance of meeting blonde-haired, blue-eyed Muslims and knowing that they were not converts. They're realising the significance of going to mosques that are older than the Sistine Chapel in Europe and knowing that they've always been prayed in. There's never been a shift. There's never been a change. For me, this would ensure my children didn't have the insecurities I had grown up with about belonging in the West, belonging in Europe.
The journey starts in Sarajevo, an Ottoman city, you call it.
Indeed, it was founded by the Ottomans, as several cities around there were. In fact, one of the cities that completely threw me was Novi Pazar, which means new bazaar, new market. And this was in the southwest of Serbia, also founded by the very same Ottoman general that founded Sarajevo. And amazingly, before I turned up to do this trip, I'd never met an indigenous Serbian Muslim. I didn't know it was a thing. Not that I'd gone looking for them, but I just assumed, you know, Serbia is an Orthodox country. And when we turned up in the south of west of Serbia to Novi Pazar in particular, we were starving. So we ordered these pizzas where sausages turned up on them. And we asked if they were pork and was astonished to be laughed at by the pizza guy who said, "Do you not realise, brother, this is a Muslim city?" And I thought, what? A whole city of Muslims in Serbia? And as we're eating our pizza on a stage in front of us out in the open air, we're treated to a choir, like presence of young Muslim girls in hijab on the stage singing nasheeds, Islamic songs, shall we say, on the stage in the summer, in the middle of August, in Serbia.
Sounds absolutely magical, actually.
Yes, and very surreal, Georgina, because it's the last thing I'd expected in Serbia.
Absolutely. Architecturally, it's so interesting. I mean, you go from tiny little places, as you say, some of them older than the Sistine Chapel, to these magnificent buildings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so some of the Some of the monuments are obviously on a grand scale. One that springs to mind immediately because of both the significance of the builders and the significance of the recent historical evidence would be the bridge over the Drina, as it's famously known, because there's a book named after it, and it's in Visegrad. And it's known as the Sokolu Mehmet Pasha Bridge. And this is because it was commissioned by Sokolu Mehmet Pasha, who was one of the grandest of grand viziers in the Ottoman Empire. His own story is fascinating because he was part of that awful practice the Ottomans took part in called Devsirme, where they would take the children of Christian families mainly and enlist them within the Ottomans, and they would sometimes rise up to these ranks, and he became the prime minister essentially of the Ottoman Empire. And then his friend and fellow Devsirme, also a victim of this, Mimar Sinan, which many of the better, more well-read listeners will know, is probably the greatest Muslim architect in history who built the bridge. And the bridge is stunning. It's lasted all these centuries and just visually is an amazing piece of architecture that straddles the River Drina. But of course, it's also got a dark history because most recently during the 90s war, it became the scene of the genocide in that town where I think, please don't quote me off the top of my head, but almost 3,000 people were murdered at the bridge and chucked off the bridge, and famously the waters of the river beneath were turned red because of how tragic and how disgusting this was.
Absolutely. What really struck me was when you were in some of the smaller mosques and you had all the Christian iconography on the one side, or tombs rather.
Yes, tombs.
Christian iconography on one side and then all of the Muslim, but all together in the one space.
Yes. So these experiences actually, the ones that you're describing in the book, took place in Bulgaria during the formative period of the plan to do the trip that leads to the book. And it's the one that made me realise that there is this pluralist practice that took place as well. This kind of intimate tolerance, as I end up naming the chapter, the introduction chapter, which I found wonderfully encouraging and to go back to your words, hopeful. You know, of course, there are Muslims who insist that, you know, all Muslim spaces should be Muslim and Christians who insist all Christian spaces should be Christian. But for me as an observer, I just found it wonderful to turn up at this tomb, which was the tomb of Demir Baba, who incidentally the locals believe is St. George, the St. George, of course, of England's history and the flag and the patron saint and everything else. And so when I was in there, I was just blown away how neatly the line had been drawn. And there was clearly this wonderful agreement where you can keep your icons on this side, we'll keep ours on this side, but, you know, we'll come in and we'll share the space and there's absolutely no problem. And here's the wonderful thing. Not only do we not hear about this, but this goes on across the globe and I can testify to it, having travelled all over and come across this, even in places like Thailand, where I went to the tomb of a Muslim sultan in the south of Thailand and found a local Buddhist coming there to pay his respects. So actually, this is more normal across the globe than we want to admit. And maybe that's because the voices that sometimes speak for us too loudly are the ones who'd rather it wasn't happening.
Where do the Jews fit in?
So the Jews fit in wonderfully for me as a Muslim of Europe now, because on this journey, I came to the realization that one of my proudest pieces of Muslim heritage as a European is that for 12 centuries, since the 8th century up until the Nazi Holocaust, some of the safest, if not the safest, spaces for Europe's most persecuted religious group, the Jews, tended to be under Muslim rule, and or in Muslim lands, however you wish to put that. And what I mean by that is I realised that there was a continuation without breakage when the Alhambra decree was made in Spain in the late 15th century, and the Catholic monarchs went back on their words and decided to actually kick the Muslims and the Jews out of Spain. The Ottoman Sultan Bayezid II sent his navy to go and collect these refugees, these persecuted peoples, and said to them, you can come and stay under my protection. You have my guarantee that you will be allowed to live safely in my land as long as you pay your taxes. And it was as simple as that. And of course, you know, there are the nuances of whether they were treated equally as the ruling class, the Muslims and whatever else. But certainly they were safe and certainly they flourished. And certainly you can go and visit, sadly, their empty synagogues across the Balkans to this day. And the Sephardic Jewish community in particular, their European presence remained for 12 centuries because they felt safe under Muslim European rule. And that's something I'm immensely proud of.
Now, you talk about sort of sense of identity, and particularly when in Macedonia, North Macedonia and Macedonia, and the whole row about sort of laying claim to an identity and a cultural heritage that's more allied to Western Europe. And I wonder then, I mean, you title the chapter, Whose Heritage Is It Anyway? Whose heritage is it anyway?
Well, for that, I think you need to engage with some, you know, and I did, with some professors of those great universities like Oxford, Cambridge and all the others who are essentially experts when it comes to Hellenic history, heritage and claiming this history and heritage. Because, of course, although I label it Western European heritage, anyone who knows the map of Europe knows that Greece is actually to the right. You know, to the east of these countries. And yet, of course, it is seen as the bedrock of Western civilization, so to speak. So what's happening here is the famous Macedonian history and heritage of Europe, you know, in other words, Alexander the Great and his legacy, that's what the previous administration in North Macedonia wanted to claim as theirs and built in a very short space of time all these rapid statues and started to claim many of the iconography of that dynasty as their own. And the problem that the Greeks had with this, who claimed that it's theirs and theirs only, which in itself is problematic for a lot of people, but we won't go into that, is that Alexander the Great's empire went as far as India in terms of towards the east. But in terms of going westwards, it only came to the very southern parts of what is North Macedonia today and didn't even go stretch to Skopje. And this was the problem that the Greeks had, in that most of what is North Macedonia today did not fall into that ancient Macedon's territories.
I wonder what you discovered about Islamophobia through the writing of the book.
Well, I didn't discover that much more than I already knew. But what I did discover is that so many incidents of Islamophobic atrocities took place that I wasn't aware of. I already knew that why the Islamophobia was there. But there was two things I think I want to make points about today on this. Is one, I was absolutely horrified to learn, for example, that in Bulgaria, so many hundreds of thousands, I think 800,000 people forcibly had their names changed from Muslim names to non-Muslim names in this kind of warped and bizarre and twisted effort to try and kind of de-Islamize the people and Bulgarianize them during a horrific process known as the revival process. And then, you know, through various waves, they were essentially kicked out in what became the largest post-World War II mass migration, where all these ethnic Turks, whose historicity goes four or five centuries at least back in Bulgaria, were told, go and bugger off back to Turkey. But where in Turkey? And that was something I didn't know. And I felt angry that this isn't a part of our mainstream European history. But the other thing in terms of Islamophobia that I at least theorize, and I feel like I kind of allude to and prove in some degree, is that I believe one of the reasons we don't embrace Eastern Europe as Europe proper, and we always seem to want to qualify it with this idea that it is Eastern, is because we want to other that part of Europe. Now, we're told this is because, oh, it's different to us. It's always been behind the Iron Curtain. But I actually offer the suggestion, the fact that it was Muslim for five or six centuries is probably the biggest issue us in the west half of Europe have with it. Because in embracing it as Europe proper, we have to embrace and acknowledge and accept that we do have a living indigenous Muslim presence. And that doesn't sit comfortably with everyone across the whole of Europe.
Yes, because, I mean, you say in the book, modern Eastern Europe's popular image is a secular, harsh, grey place ravaged by ethnic wars. And that's the accepted wisdom, isn't it? And you found that, yeah, there was so much more to it than that.
Oh, I didn't just find there was so much more to it. I didn't find this description. I didn't find it anywhere. I didn't experience it anywhere. Apart from when I looked at certain blocks built by people like Enver Hoxha and that was the only thing I could describe as a grey block. Everything else was beautiful, vibrant, colourful, flourishing, friendly, warm. And as you probably know from reading the Albanian chapter, I had to overcome my own prejudices that I'd become susceptible to as somebody growing up in the west half of Europe and reading the literature written by the west half of Europe on this part of Europe. I had to put aside my prejudices and I had to examine them as well in order to enter Albania and not freak out at the first sight of something going wrong, thinking that this was some dangerous badland as it had been consistently described in history. So even I'm susceptible to this as a travel writer whose literary heritage is built on English-speaking writers from the Western half mainly. And when I got beyond that, and this is why Evliya Çelebi became so important, because I realised when Evliya Çelebi wrote about Albania, he didn't have these prejudices. And he was writing sometimes in the same periods as many of these writers historically. And so that's another reason why those lenses are important. And going back to the point I made about Islamophobia, often the writers who wrote about this in the English language were people who were non-Muslims, living at a time when Islam was seen as a threat. The Turks were seen as a threat. And I needed a voice that didn't see them as a threat, because I needed to look at this as my heritage and not the other side of Europe.
What about Patrick Lee Fermor, who, of course, went across much of the same territory?
Yes, so Patrick Lee Fermor is an interesting scenario because I love his writing. And in the main, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed his wanderings from the Hook of Holland across to Istanbul, you know, just after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And already you can hear the romanticism in my voice, because it was such a romantic thing to do. This young boy from a privileged background picks up his saddlebag and off he goes on foot across Europe, essentially. And he enters into these parts of Europe that, you know, until very recently, only I think a decade before he was travelling, was still very much Muslim Europe, because they were part of the Ottoman Empire. And so he goes across and he offers these wonderfully vivid descriptions of women still in veils and wearing what we might describe as quote-unquote Islamic clothing, and men in fezes and smoking hookahs and scenes that could be North Africa and Tunis or Algeria today. But again, and this is not to suggest that Lee Fermor isn't an amazing writer or isn't an important voice. All of these writers are important people, but there's no denying Patrick Lee Fermor comes from a particular cultural backdrop, and nobody is completely unbiased. So even he describes the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople as the greatest atrocity to ever be experienced by Western Europe. And my point being that he's looking at Romans, who were essentially colonizers as well, as great people of the past. And most English white Western writers of the Western half will look at the Greeks and Romans as these great empires, whereas they won't look at the Ottomans as a great empire, despite the fact that historians accept all of them were great empires and all of them had pros and cons.
Absolutely. I mean, we keep using the word hopeful, but it's also a book of wonderful discovery. And of course, right now we can't really travel, which as a travel writer must be particularly frustrating for you. There is one way, though, that we can open ourselves to other elements of the culture, particularly if we're here in Britain and want to explore, because you created Britain's first Muslim heritage trails.
Indeed, and thank you for bringing that to everyone's attention, Georgina, because of course you don't have to get on a plane for that. In fact, if like me you're often very London centric, you only need a short ride out of London to get to Woking. So Woking was, at one point, it became the Mecca of Europe, okay, which essentially was saying that it was the heart of anything Islamic, especially in the western half of Europe. And it was centered around that beautiful, often neglected, often forgotten mosque known as the Shah Jahan Mosque in Woking, which is like a miniature Taj Mahal. And it was the first purpose-built mosque in northwestern Europe. And what we did was we realized that there was this fascinating period of history and heritage all around them, three significant sites: the first Muslim burial ground in Britain, the only Muslim soldiers' burial ground in Britain, were all within a short space of this mosque, obviously, because they were centred around the mosque. So we created these trails where people can visit the three sites, learn about their history through a trail called the Woking Trail, which can be downloaded free. And then we also created another trail once you're in the cemetery called the Muslim Cemetery Walk, where you can walk around and find the graves of the last Ottoman princess, lords and ladies that converted to Islam, royals that converted to Islam, the earliest English translator, and an actual direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad who's buried there.
Absolutely extraordinary. Tariq, it's been really wonderful talking to you about this book, which gives us this amazing insight into the living legacy of Islam in Europe, and also about how we can find out more here in the UK. The book is called Minarets in the Mountains, A Journey into Muslim Europe. It's by Tariq Hussain and it's out now. Tariq, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for having me on, Georgina.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to the producer, Nora Hull, researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our sound engineer, Sam Impey. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.